So the Dalai Lama was interviewed by some journalists, and it so happened that just before these interviews, he had been visited by an elderly monk who had come to ask him to do a set of advanced practices. And as it is sometimes in the various Tibetan traditions, they can be quite physical and over long periods of time. And the Dalai Lama with kindness said, "Well, you don't really have to do that, and that's not necessary." And the monk took it the wrong way and committed suicide in disappointment. And so the journalist had heard about this and asked the Dalai Lama, so how did you get over it? How did you get over this? And there was a lot of conversation between the Dalai Lama and the translator, talking back and forth and back and forth, and clearly the Dalai Lama could not understand the question. There was some kind of confusion. And then he replied, "I didn't." And there is something about that that I think is extremely important for us. Because on one hand, as we practice, as we deepen our presence, there is a clarification and healing process where we do let go. We shed layers of contraction, of ego identity, of self-images, of personal history, on one hand. But what the Dalai Lama, in his way of relating to this question, teaches us is we don't need to get over anything. Really, truly not. Can you sense the potential freedom in that? That it can all be here. So, the one you lost, that you can't get over, maybe you don't need to get over. Maybe the healing journey can take just as long as it wants to. The sense of inner spaciousness, a sign of freedom, of inner transparency, of openness, is not dependent on that kind of trajectory where we need to get over things and get on with things. It's so often that people come and sit down and say, "I should be over this already. I don't understand why I'm not over this already. Or why I can't learn this," whatever it is one wants to learn. "Why does it take me so long time to get this?" So I like to reflect a bit tonight on how we relate to time and space in our practice, what actually opens our being. In the Diamond Sutta, one of the oldest poetic texts, collections from the Buddhist tradition, it is said that one guy named Subhuti came to the Buddha and started asking questions on impermanence, the changing nature of everything, life and death, the nature of reality. And it is said that the Buddha said simply, poetically, "This fleeting world a star at dawn, bubble in a stream, flash of lightning in a summer cloud, flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. And we can have that sense sometime, can we not? Of everything's insubstantiality. It may be a lightness of being, but as we begin to become a little bit more liquid, a bit unglued, we begin to open up, it can feel a bit unsettling, like some of you have been reporting today. Like it all seems a bit dreamlike. And there out on the grass are the zombies walking. It's like, what are they doing? What? It's like, what's going on here? Really? And everybody's taking the food. It can get a bit confusing, right? It's like, and we keep saying practice and practice. And it's like, and yes, it all starts to be a bit dreamlike, and the rest of the world also a little bit sort of dreamlike, crazy. So how can we, where do we find the freedom in that? So when we do the zombie dance on the lawn, actually at Gaia House, at old Gaia House in England, one of the old Insight Meditation Retreat Centers, it's at another location now since many years, but at old Gaia House, it was a rather small place, and there was a bunch of white blankets, thick woolly blankets from India, and most people coming to this retreat center had spent far too much time for their own good in India, and then they came to England to practice at this retreat center, and with sandals, and then people would, you know, how it is in England, it's cold and rainy, and when you go walk so slow, you get cold. So people wrapped themselves in the blankets, and then they were doing the slow walking in the garden. But then they were also kind of starting to walk into the village, you know, just not really thinking about that maybe this could actually have an impact. And there was one particular time, one evening, when the managers came in, and very sweetly said, okay, we've had some complaints from the people in the village. It was Christmas time, and the villagers didn't dare to come and sing the Christmas carols at the door because they were scared of the zombies. But this slowing down, the taking oneself out of the habitual rhythm, it really starts to work on us. We can't help but notice things. And inner space is needed for being curious, for asking questions, not necessarily finding answers, but asking questions. That spirit of asking questions within and then waiting patiently. So often, and it's also how we're trained, right? So we ask questions and then we kind of try to pull them out of ourselves, or we try to kind of pack them together from what we know. It's like there must be possible to kind of build an answer from what I know. So how does that work with the big questions about the nature of existence, freedom? there is something really beautiful in daring to ask. Ask abundantly, but then also shut up and listen. It's like we need the zombie space to really listen. There's a sweet little nothing kind of poem from Hafiz, the tongue of the invisible. He calls this poem an astronomical question. What would happen if God leaned down and gave you a full wet kiss? Hafiz doesn't mind answering astronomical questions like that. You would surely start reciting all day rough poems like this. That kind of questions. Being so preoccupied with our own trajectory, you know, A to B, and where am I going, and after this, and how can I make full use of? Do we really linger and ask these sweet, silly, astronomical questions? You know, that kind of questions that children can have. I once overheard my children, they were quite a bit smaller, thank God, and they were sitting down discussing my funeral. And so I joined the conversation, and they were really excited about it. It's like, yeah, probably by the water, she would probably like that, but in a way it doesn't matter if she's already dead, but we could get a stone. And it's like, what kind of flowers? And just that kind of... And then, of course, it led into, like, yeah, but then what do we do? Yeah, but we'll get all her money. And I thought, okay, right. You need to grow up. Get a reality check here. But that kind of like, okay, and like, how would we live then? What would we do? And it's like, all that questioning. Right? It's great. The more we recognize and appreciate a sense of spaciousness. And how do we invite spaciousness? Yes, by slowing down. It's my birthday tradition, so I don't need to do something special necessarily, but I like to just take all the time in the world. Even if it's just going to my favorite cafe and it's like, what should we get? And yes, maybe there is something or maybe there is nothing that pulls my attention, but just taking time. Just going slow to the bus or for a walk. And that most sacred art of doing absolutely nothing. It's like the seriously informal kind of practice. And sometime on retreat, actually, there is a lot of abundant opportunity for that kind of practice of doing nothing, absolutely informal. But our head just walks around with the schedule. It's like, when will the bell ring? The sittings are too long for me. And, I have to, you know, we're so time bound that it starts to feel like a lot. And of course, this way of keeping time is really new. I mean, it's so extremely new. It's not that long ago that had we gathered, would be something like Dharma talk. Well, before it gets really dark, let's gather. And then you wait until everyone is here, and then it kind of... So, it's not so long ago when we followed the sun. I think it was mid-1800s in UK, and where the railroad network was early. So different stations had different times because it wasn't a centralized timing system. And that was really difficult. And it was actually because of the railway that time started to be centralized, because it was so difficult, you know, trying to figure out when the train would come and, you know. But seriously, it was really difficult. And that's what caused... And now, you know, we're down to the second, right? Like really to the second. So I could say that the sense of timelessness, and particularly the sense of space, is one of the most fundamental expressions of true nature. And in the process of awakening, the sense of space starts to replace our ego identity and all the ways we get so preoccupied with ourselves and our life and our problems. When we start to have a sense of space, it actually starts to come into place instead of that contracted I and me and... And with that, perhaps comes that feeling, yes, I'm somebody, but not as much somebody as I usually think. It's a more fluid sense. You know, we all have distinct flavors, right? Like, really. We're different beings, and we should be. And that's actually quite wonderful. You know, we really do have our particular qualities, particular expression. And that will not change, but the sense of self becoming much more fluid. Not so much of a burden, not particularly an issue. I was sleeping outside with some friends under a starry sky, in sleeping bags. And then one of my friends said, when we were laying there looking up, you know, maybe we're not looking up, maybe we're looking down. Yeah, right. I mean, of course we are. I mean, isn't that interesting? Here we're sitting, and the fact that we're on this little thing in the middle of absolute vastness, that's moving. I mean, how crazy is that? And then there is this mysterious thing called gravity. Oh, I really like gravity. It just keeps us stuck to the surface. And we're upside down. I mean, we're on the side all the time. Isn't that quite wonderful? You know, that we're sitting here and looking down into space. Like, really? And what happens with our inner experience when we just shift our perspective somewhat? It just kind of gives a bit more space, right? Like, oh yeah. Rilke says, "Oh, not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition, shut out from the laws of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming." Did you have that sense sometime during this retreat that when the wind comes, it kind of, it touches your skin, but it also kind of moves through, right? Did you have that? Or the sound, they kind of reverberate through. You can have that sense of not so much boundary between inner and outer. Not so much separation and partition, but a permeability, transparency. So this then with our time fixation, I'm thinking, I was reading recently, maybe not that recent actually, some time ago, about the world's oldest tree that happens to be located in Sweden, in Fulufjällen. And it's 9,550 years old, give or take 50 years. And it started growing at the end of the Ice Age. Just as the ice was receding, this tree took root, started growing, not in a hurry. So this was really, you know, it was the time, the Neolithic time. You know, no houses. I mean, in human history, it's a kind of nothing, right? And that tree is still growing. What does it do to your heart to just know that? That there's a tree that's been growing rings very, very slowly since the Ice Age. You know, still there. Quite often when we talk about ourselves and then we talk about nature, we talk about nature as other, but we are nature, right? We're earth beings. I mean, whatever other fantasies we may have, and how much we encapsulate ourselves in technology and produce man-made stuff, we're nature. And what does it do to our being to actually let ourselves feel that? To let yourself be a natural creature. Just the baby of the earth. With as much belonging as that old pine tree. Did you ever wake up, happens to me sometimes, not knowing where you are and sort of what time it is? It can be quite unsettling, right? Like it's usually, it happens something in the nervous system, like, oh right, here I am. And then we find ourselves again, right? I'm in this location. The more we relax into presence, the more timelessness becomes experientially available to us. Actually, we literally start to stretch the now. The now becomes more expansive. mostly in life, how most people live is that the past is very big, and then the future is very big, and then you're kind of squeezed in the middle, sort of leaning a little bit forward, and and the more we embody our presence, the now starts to expand, and time too becomes more smooth. Not just our inner experience, but the sense of time becomes more liquid, more flowing. Often we have very little trust in that action can come from another place than the willful one, where it's like, right, now I have to do it. Can we actually operate and function from a place of timelessness and vastness of space? Or what will happen with us then? Will we just kind of sit, right? Is that the idea with meditation practice, that we're sort of gradually, we're just going to gravitate to this room, and then we will just sort of boom. Like, we won't even do the zombie walk, we'll just sit and be this time-space existence. Is that it? I think it's really good for us to share a narrative about time perspective, since time units gets shorter and shorter, and so it actually affects our sense of ourselves, it affects our sense of history, it affects our sense of history and future. It's interesting, this guy named Danny Hillis, he had this wild idea. And it's always great when people have wild and creative ideas. So this is how he describes it. I cannot imagine the future, but I care about it. I'm part of a story that starts long before I can remember, and continues long beyond when anyone will remember me. I sense that I'm alive at a time of important change, and I feel a responsibility to make sure that the change comes out well. I plant my acorns knowing I will never harvest the oaks. I want to build a clock that ticks once a year. The century hand advances once every 100 years. The cuckoo comes out on the millennium. I want the cuckoo to come out every millennium for the next 10,000 years. And then this clock was built in a mountain in southern USA, this enormous thing. I think there's something absolutely sweet for a person to think, okay, 10,000 years from now, lovely, we will be around, and let's have a clock that comes out and ticks, or makes cuckoo, or some kind of sound, every millennium, every 1,000 years. And apparently he programmed the cuckoo sound to be different also every 1,000 years. As if it would make a difference. But there's something really touching about that, I think. It's just new and fresh. So that kind of long thinking. What kind of generational scale questions? What kind of generational scale practices and projects can it suggest for us? One question it could give rise to is the question, are we being good ancestors? We, the living generation. How can we let that question in? What does it mean to be a good ancestor for all those that will come after us? How can that inspire and inform my practice? Not in that way where it's like, oh, I'm burned out already, so please, you know, I can't think of anyone but my immediate family and the generations for the coming 10,000 years. It's like, oh, kill me now. How can we let it in? That sense of kinship, of earth belonging. It's like, how can you take your seat on the cushion and feel, here I am? Yes, just a bubble in a stream. It's all so brief, but how can I practice feeling, oh, yes. Hello, you guys. I'm your ancestor, and I've taken my seat. That you did that. You know, so 14 billion years ago is just a figure for us, right? But then there was nothing. There was nothing. I think it's amazing that we know there was nothing. There was nothing around us. No time, no space. It's like the darkest emptiness you can imagine, and the darkest emptiness you cannot imagine. That dark. And then the universe appeared. Smaller than an atom. That small. Incredibly hot. And it contained everything in the universe today. It's like there we go about and it's like, oh, I have to write those emails. Okay, so it was that small. And then it just expanded. And energy started to shatter and form new strange things. Electromagnetism, gravity, yay! Good gravity that keeps us here. Grounded to our seat. Can you imagine how difficult practice would be without gravity? I mean, you think this is hard. It's like, woo! Oh no, Johanna! There she went, lost in space. That would be hard. And then it started to come together, congeal, to create matter. But all in the first second. Like it just happened like that. And the more atoms started to cloud together, then gravity became more powerful. And then the temperature started to rise. 10 million degrees. It just started to rise and rise and rise, like real cooking, like serious cooking. And then from this cooking, the stars appeared. I mean, listen to our history. It's like, who could ever make this up? It's like it's... So the stars appeared. And this is the time all the core elements are there. Anyone wearing any gold jewelry? Yay! Wedding ring. Comes from that time. Right? The core elements. Forged in a supernova. Then the universe became more and more complex, chemically more complex. Planets, moons, galaxies, and then living organisms. These weird packages of chemicals, double helix DNA. I mean, if we really look at us, what a beautiful but absolutely strange configuration, bone and tissue. And I mean, it's like, there is so much going on in here, right? Like so much. So this is probably the most New Agey thing I ever have said and will say, but my dear one, you're made out of stardust, and it's the truth.
Now.
Yeah, I see the shine. So there is an unbroken line. There's an unbroken line. We're this evolutionary pulse. We're part of it. This is our ancestral line from that moment of nothing to everything. That's the energy that makes our blood pulsate in our veins. And then there's this little inner critic, you know, that sits somewhere and says, oh, you don't look good enough. And that's when you tell the inner critic, well, I'm stardust. Objectively speaking. So Rabindranath Tagore says, the same stream of life that runs through my veins day and night runs through the world, dances in rhythmic measures. It's the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth into numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and of flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and flow. I feel my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride from the life throb of ages dances in my blood this moment. So continuing this sort of timeline, you know, the dinosaurs were here for a long time. They were not so into meditation practice, as far as we know, about 100 million generations of them. And there's been about 10 million generations of mammals of all shapes and forms. And then there is us, like 20, 30,000 generations of human beings. Like we're so young. Like we're really, really new here. And we have all this amazing capacity and we don't yet know how to operate it, right? And so we're trying out all sort of different things. And at times quite dangerous for the earth, but we're trying all sort of things. The Buddha lived a breath ago. It's so very new. It's all so very new. So that really makes us the ancestors of the future ones to come. So One of the things that are possible for us is to take the wisdom practices of those that lived before us and engage with them and embody them and practice well to become what is possible for human beings to become. To do what needs to be done. To make the teachings ours and personal and relevant for our time and our location. So that it has an effect and ripples onwards to the future ones. Wes Nisker, who's a teacher in this tradition in America and a poet, he said very simply but sweetly, one of the best things I learned from meditation is that I'm alive. While this should be obvious to all of us, I have never let this truth reverberate inside me. Now I know myself as one of the living. I'm a live one. You too are a member of the Sangha. Glad you could make it. So what's here for us then is this possibility to dance both with learning new skills, knowing our postal code and person number and all that stuff, and our Buddha nature, our boundlessness. The more we relax into our beingness, in effortless non-doing, it doesn't really matter what our arms are doing. It's not that we have to stop. We're just doing it for a little while to remember. Just to remember being. To remember, to let our bodies remember space and timelessness. But then we can take the boat out on the lake and row, and we'd be doing nothing, going nowhere. Build an empire, start a company, write a book, do stuff in life. But from being simple, relaxed, open, spacious being. Hafiz again, that brings in this beautiful quality of innocence. You know, at some point when, as we mature, it turns into innocence. Innocence, actually, which I think is very interesting, in the Sufi tradition, it's the seed of brilliancy. It's like if you want really great ideas, right, and you try to think something great, you ever try that? Like, now I should really create something intelligent here. Brilliancy arises from innocence, that defenselessness and openness. So Hafiz then, he sweetly says, slipping on my shoes, boiling water, toasting bread, buttering the sky. That should be enough contact with God in one day to make anyone crazy. The stuff that perhaps we seek of special experiences, some kind of internal big bang that will just sort of make us see stars and then we're sort of done. What if it never ends, just as human dynamic evolution just continues and continues, earthly, universal movement continues, that impulse? What if awakening continues endlessly? And that each thing, buttering your toast, slipping on your shoes, potentially equally sacred and absolutely wondrous. Letting oneself be that innocent and simple. So what if the remaining of our practice time here, you come into the hall quietly, plop down on the cushion or the chair, you're just hanging out. Seeing what's there, opening the inner eyes. Be curious. Be contactful. Not making a big deal out of it. Have a laugh at feeling that it's hard work. And then, oh, here's that bell again. Perhaps I'll go out. Hang out with the zombies. Make it light. Make it innocent. And remember your location this evening in this vastness of endless stars. This small, small, small planet, this little blue pearl that we're glued to. Spinning around. So let us practice like good ancestors for may all beings may all beings awaken. May all beings be free in heart and mind. May all beings live with joy and creativity.